ecumenical that way. You know? Okay, y'all. Let's get started this morning. We are in the final throes of the book of Joshua. We've got this week where we're going to do chapters 20 and 21. And then we're going to do the final few chapters week after next. Because next week, Yost Nixon will be here, one of the missionaries that we support, the Training Leaders International. He's going to be preaching in our worship service, but he's also going to be, during the Sunday school time, doing a bit of a presentation. It's not a sales pitch. He said, believe me, I don't do the sales pitch. He's just doing a presentation. I'm leaving that to the elders to do whenever they want to do it. But we already support him. But anyway, he is going to be kind of doing a presentation about the work of Training Leaders International and how and some of his experiences in training pastors around the world. Like I remember he told me the when he was approaching me about doing a class, I think in Liberia in 2018 or 19 or something like that, he said, yeah, the last class I taught in Ethiopia, we taught under a mango tree all week. That was pretty cool. You know, pretty cool. So anyway, but he's going to be, he's got a great insight on Christianity around the world, great insight on it. Not just in one country, but all around. So he's been to Brazil and India and Africa. He's been all over doing what he does. And he's one of my, I hesitate to say this, he's one of my heroes. He's a hero. So anyway, but then the week after that, we will wrap up in Joshua. And then after that, we're going to actually just move right into the Judges, since they just really are a bit of a continuum. But this week, we're looking at Joshua 20 and Joshua 21. Each chapter basically has a main theme to it. Chapter 20 is going to be on the concept of cities of refuge, when they establish cities of refuge in the Promised Land. And then chapter 21 will be dealing with the allotments to the tribe of Levi, to the Levites. Because that was different from all the other tribes. Anyway, as we move into Joshua chapter 20, it starts off with saying, Then the Lord said to Joshua, say to the people of Israel, appoint the cities of refuge of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the manslayer who strikes any person without intent or unknowingly may flee there, they shall be for you a refuge from the avenger of blood. He shall flee to one of these cities and shall stand at the entrance of the gate of the city and explain his case to the elders of that city. And then they shall take him into the city and give him a place. And he shall remain with them. And if the avenger of blood pursues him, they shall not give up the manslayer into his hand, because he struck his neighbor unknowingly and did not hate him in the past. And he shall remain in that city until he has stood before the congregation for judgment, until the death of him who is high priest at the time. Then the manslayer may return to his own town and his own home, to the town from which he fled. And then it basically breaks down the cities. So the principle is, if someone takes the life of another accidentally, or unknowingly, he can flee to a city of refuge and be protected from the avenger of blood, which is the victim's family. There can be somebody from within the family of the person who was killed who can be called, they sometimes call it the redeemer or the avenger, who can use the principle of eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, and try and take the other person's life, and would not be held guilty. But this is until he can stand before the congregation and his case be heard. Now, what is important here is involuntary manslaughter or accidental death as opposed to murder. That's the difference between the two. And it shows here that God takes into account motives and intents. God takes into account motives and intents in these cases. He doesn't just look on the external of what happened. Okay, somebody died, somebody's going to pay for it. He looks at motives and he looks at intents. And when it says here, appoint the cities of refuge of which I spoke to you through Moses, one scriptural example of that is in Deuteronomy chapter 19, verses 1 through 10. And in that section, it gives us a little more detail, and I'll read that for you. When the Lord your God, this is, by the way, this is Moses, you know, of course, Deuteronomy is him recounting the law. It actually goes back also to Numbers 35, 36 in there. Numbers 35. But it says, when the Lord your God cuts off the nations whose land the Lord your God is giving you, and you dispossess them and dwell in their cities and in their houses, you shall, remember this is their, they haven't entered the promised land yet, you shall set apart three cities for yourselves in the land that the Lord your God is giving you to possess. You shall measure the distances and divide into three parts the area of the land that the Lord your God gives you as a possession, so that any manslayer can flee to them. So, this is the provision for the manslayer who is fleeing there, who by fleeing there may save his life. If anyone kills his neighbor unintentionally without having hated him in the past, and he gives an example, as when someone goes into the forest with his neighbor to cut wood, and his hand swings the axe to cut down a tree, and the head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor so that he dies. He may flee to one of these cities and live, lest the avenger of blood in hot anger pursue the manslayer and overtake him because the way is long and strike him fatally, though the man did not deserve to die since he had not hated his neighbor in the past. Therefore I command you, you shall set apart three cities, and if the Lord your God enlarges your territory as he has sworn to your fathers and gives you all the land that he promised to give to your fathers, provided you are careful to keep all this commandment which I command you today, by loving the Lord your God and by walking ever in his ways, then you shall add three other cities to those three. So it will be a total of six. Lest innocent blood be shed in your land that the Lord your God has given you for an inheritance, and so the guilt of bloodshed be upon you. So the application is, he said, he used an example. And there are other examples of this, of course. But two men chopping wood, the axe handle flies off from the head, and the metal kills the other man. He didn't hate it. This was not an intentional act. It was an accident. But some of the applications of the principle that he gives here is, one, the cities must be relatively close by so that he can flee to them and not be overtaken. That's why, notice how it said, divide the land up and put three cities, and then if you get all this land, get three more cities, to make sure that there's a relatively close place for them to flee to. If you go back to Joshua, notice how it says in verse 9, these were the cities, after they had designated some cities, Kadesh, Shechem, and Kiriath Arba, and then they also later did Bezer, Ramoth, and Gilead, and Golan. But these were the cities designated for all the people of Israel and for the stranger sojourning among them. That's going to be important because we're going to go back to this in a minute about a controversy that's going on in our day to day. So that anyone who killed a person without intent could flee there so that he might not die by the hand of the avenger of blood till he stood before the congregation. So even foreigners in the land, the sojourner among you, shall have access to justice and the protection of the law. Even the sojourner that is among you will still have access to that. Let me make a couple of comments about that. First of all, we're going to talk in a minute about, in our day-to-day, people have misapplied this principle to the development of what they call sanctuary cities. You also heard that in the news and all the stuff that goes on about that. In fact, when I was researching all this, if you look in the Wikipedia article for it, they actually try to connect it to multiple religions, but also the concept of cities of refuge. Problem is, that is a misapplication of that principle. They can take some of it, but they can't take it to where they've gone with it. And we'll talk about that in a second. But another example of where this has a huge impact for the good is that sojourners among you, or non-citizens, or the alien among you, still has access to protection and justice, not only the citizens. And from recent history, 20th century history, during the rise of Nazi Germany, one of the justifications that they used for all the injustices and violence that they perpetrated against the Jews started, besides just the typical rhetoric that was going on, but from a legal standpoint, they declared Jews non-citizens. And eventually, not even people. And at that point, legally, not morally or ethically, but legally, they could do whatever they wanted. They could abuse them in any form or fashion. Take their property, you know, haul them off, kill them. They could do whatever they wanted. And legally, in the laws of Germany, they didn't break any laws. And see, if there were things like the cities of refuge, see, the city of refuge establishes the principle that even the foreigner among you has protection of the law. Okay, but they also come under the authority of the law as well, but they also have basic protection in a certain situation. And we have to understand specifically in the cities of refuge, we're looking at an accidental death. We're not talking about everything on the planet, but we are talking about accidental death. It's very specific. But what must he do when he runs and flees to the city of refuge? First of all, he must present himself to the elders. He can't just sneak in and hide somewhere. You know, he has to present himself to the elders first. And then he must remain there in the city. If you go back to the initial passage in Numbers chapter 35, 26 through 28, he says, and this is actually the Lord speaking to Moses. He said, "But if the manslayer shall at any time go beyond the boundaries of the city of refuge to which he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the boundaries of his city of refuge, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of his blood." You know, for he must remain in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. So, he must remain there in the city, or he is unprotected, and does so at his own risk. Does so at his own risk. Yes?
That's just the man himself. What about his family?
It would be the man himself.
So his family's not...
No,
not
because there's family. There's other scriptures that come into play there that you can't penalize the child for the crime of the parent.
What if you wanted them to live with him? Like what if?
Oh, they can live with him. They can live with him. But she's talking about the protection.
Well, I was gonna ask that also.
They could go there and try and live there. Yeah, because see, they are free to go from one place to another, other than the fact that they're leaving the land of their inheritance.
Yeah.
But they can go be with the father or whatever. They could. I don't think there's any compelling reason why they wouldn't.
Because they could have been stuck there a long time, right? Because if the high priest was young,
how does that figure into the, you know, him being acquitted or not, or saying?
Well, there's we'll look at that in a second.
Okay.
The meaning of waiting until the death of the high priest at that time is debated. Okay? The passage of time can help temper or anger to subside. There is that. There are some commentators. In fact, probably the main commentator that I've used for this study has been Dale Ralph Davis. And he actually says, you know, I might be on thin hermeneutical ice here, but there's a few of us out there that think that this has something to do with an atoning aspect to the death of the high priest. There's a potential that is in there. You know, it's not something you want to die on. But there are some that feel that way. Then there are some that will say it has to do with the passage. It's just a practical aspect of the passage of time. The thing is, there's another passage when it talks about the high priest who has been anointed with oil. I mean, that's in another passage, the way it describes it. So, honestly, I don't know the answer definitively about that. Yes?
Did they have to go to these cities? Or, if it happened and the guy, you know, the guys, the Avenger, Blood Avenger, realized you didn't need to do it, I'm not mad at you, you're fine. Did they have to go to the cities of refuge?
No, they didn't have to.
This was just
is an avenue that is available to them. Now, what we have to understand that it does not mean, this is not an escape hatch or an avoidance of justice. It is not. I got to make that really clear. If you go to, in Deuteronomy 19, I know we're kind of bouncing around several different passages, but they all talk about it to understand it fully. In chapter 19 of Deuteronomy, verses 11 through 13, but if anyone hates his neighbor and lies in wait for him and attacks him and strikes him fatally so that he dies and flees into one of those cities, then the elders of the city shall send and take him from there and hand him over to the avenger of blood so that he may die. So you don't get away of something you are truly, in fact, guilty from. Your eyes shall not pity him, but you shall purge the guilt of innocent blood from Israel so that it may be well with you. The purpose here is not to excuse somebody from the shedding of innocent blood. It's to keep innocent blood from, in fact, being shed. Because if an avenger went and killed a guy in hot anger for an accidental death, he has, in fact, brought innocent blood on Israel. So they're trying to keep that from happening. They're trying to ensure that justice does, in fact, happen. But his case has to be heard. That's what it means, stand before the congregation. That's what that means, is that his case will, in fact, be heard. This is not a get-out-of-jail-free card, like in Monopoly. Cities of refuge are not the equivalent of today's sanctuary cities. They absolutely are not. Because the sanctuary cities, there is no uniform principle of what makes someone a sanctuary city around our country. But the principle is, generally speaking, those cities and their governmental and police structures at varying levels will not be cooperating with the federal authorities who are seeking to implement immigration law. And that's a problem. You've actually got a legal authority trying to do what the law states, and in fact enforce laws that have been on the books for decades. These aren't new laws with regards to illegal immigrants. They're just wanting to fulfill those mandates of the law, and the cities are basically saying, we refuse to help you. And depending on, at certain levels, they are truly standing in the way of basic justice occurring. Basic justice. Now, it varies at different levels. Like I said, there's not a uniform. Some sanctuary cities, it's very light. Some are very belligerent. It started in Berkeley, California, by the way. It goes back as far as the 1971, when they refused to help the federal authorities going after draft dodgers. They considered themselves a sanctuary for draft evaders. But if there is a biblical equivalent, if cities of refuge have a modern-day equivalent, it is not the sanctuary city. Their modern-day equivalent is seeking a change of venue. You know, if somebody has been accused of a crime, of somebody who was greatly loved, let's say the accidental death of somebody who was greatly loved in the community, and this person, you know, was not a popular person who brought this death about, they may say, I would like to request a change of venue because I do not believe I can get a fair trial here. You know, this city is under the control of this guy's kin. There's no way I'm going to get a fair trial here. I've got to go somewhere else to get a fair trial. That's the closest equivalent to a city of refuge in today's world. But what this is, it is merely a temporary refuge from avengers of blood until the details of the case can be heard and fairly ruled upon so that innocent blood will not be shed in anger. Because if he is in fact guilty of murder, he will receive the full punishment for his crime, which is death. Yes?
So if his case is heard and he's pronounced innocent, can he go back then to wherever he was, or does he have to wait on the priest?
It still says if he is found innocent, he can eventually go back, but after the death of the high priest.
Okay. So he's stuck there until...
He's stuck there until... At his own risk, if he
makes
leaves.
You more careful, I guess.
Yep. So that is the concept of cities of refuge. Now, this kind of plays a little bit into, I think I accidentally said chapter 22, the allotment to Levites. It's actually chapter 21. My bad there.
Jay, if I could come
yes.
on some of the details here. I teach quite a bit about biblical law and its application to our system of law. It's many, many aspects of our law code are founded on biblical law. Intentionally, part of that going all the way back to Alfred the Great. But some things we see here that are important, that are carryover from the common law into American law from the biblical influence. As you mentioned, the stranger, the same law was to be applied to the stranger as to the resident, natural resident of Israel, and this is a concept of the law of the land. There's one law for everybody in the land. And that comes as a term coming right out of the Magna Carta. It's very heavily dependent upon, biblical concepts. Another one is the very term that is used in this passage, the manslayer. Mm-hmm. So that's a category of crime for us of those who do not stop premeditated murder. When you kill someone, it's not premeditated murder. One of the classifications is manslaughter, of course, taken from the very terminology of this passage, the manslayer. The manslayer who's not guilty of premeditated murder is guilty of manslaughter. He is still responsible for it. And that's another principle we see here. The seriousness of dealing with killing someone, whether intentional or not. So, from a biblical perspective, it's very, very important. We might remember the passage where a guy was found dead, outside the city, and no one knew who did it. And even in that case, they had to take an animal's life, because the crime had to be atoned for. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to another principle, the blood of the innocent crying out to God from the ground for judgment. Mm-hmm. So murder, or even killing someone unintentionally, always had to be dealt with very, very seriously, because you've taken the life of man made in the intention of the likeness of God.
Well, what is your position on the whole thing about the death of the high priest? And do you feel like that represents an atoning aspect of it, or do you think it's just time?
I don't know. I'm more inclined to the time factor.
I was too. Yeah.
But the idea of the atonement is for the death. Certainly that was within the biblical law. You know, there had to be a covenant. And of course, that's the command of God going back to Genesis 9:6, that a man takes another man's life. You must put him to death because he's taken the life of one created in the image and likeness of God. And of course, that's the solution for the violence that prevailed before the flood.
Right.
So that's the general command given to all mankind. And another interesting thing that's shown here, we don't really see, generally speaking, in the biblical law, is who has to bring the judgment. Because typically, crimes were to be tried before an appointed judge, but not a jury trial.
Right.
But in this case, where you're dealing with determining not just both facts and motive, not just facts, it's tried before the congregation. So it's something more equivalent to a jury trial here, where
it's not now. You don't think it's mob rule?
No.
Because it still might be effectively ruled. Because this is what I was going to talk about in 21. It's connected to the cities where the priests are present.
Well, this is true. That's right. And of course, the priests were also part of the appellate court system,
right?
As well,
yeah.
But it's not that they're, you know, of course you start with reporting into the elders,
right?
Who were the you know, sort of the local, like city council,
right?
Responsible for governmental affairs in the city. But the trial was to be held, the final trial, the judgment was determined by the congregation, a jury of the citizens.
Yeah.
So this is where, you know, you can see that, and of course, a judge trial in the scriptures were very important, and the judge was to investigate everything very carefully. And there had to be, you know, sufficient witnesses, and et cetera. But in this case, of course, as the circumstance laid out for the example, these are two guys by themselves out in the wilderness, and the accident flies off. We assume there's no witnesses.
Right.
So, you know, the only, you've got one witness, the guy who was there, the accident came off and it hit the other guy and he died. So, how do you determine there's not multiple witnesses? Biblical law, there had to be multiple witnesses to find a death penalty.
Right, which is there was in Numbers, there was another, the passage that comes right after this deals with the fact there have to be multiple witnesses.
Yeah. And so you know, under a judge trial, if there were no other witnesses, you could not determine guilt.
Right.
In that case. But it is interesting that you do have the congregation. It's the only passage we have throughout the biblical law where the congregation was required to be involved in making the judgment.
Yeah. Well, we don't know exactly to what degree. We assume like a jury, but we don't know exactly the details.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the entire people.
Right.
But a gathering of people.
Yeah.
To again discern motive.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so that's I think all quite important. And the last thing I wanted to mention is the idea of the avenger of blood. You know, the relative who's wanting to see this prosecutor. And that takes us back again to the seriousness of anyone who kills another man, even unintentionally. That it's a very serious thing. And yes, I mean, it talks about the anger, you know, the heat of the anger, so the avenger of blood protects it. But also, you know, why we might say, well, why was the avenger of blood justified at all? You know, was he justified? And you know, yes, he was justified in going after the person who killed his relative. At least, you know, see the crime prosecuted, you might say, very much. Because, again, of the seriousness of taking a man's life. And so the guy who had done this, you know, he might be, you know, many years in the city of refuge, you know, it's going to affect his entire life,
mm-hmm.
his exactly. ability to earn an income, provide for his family, perhaps. So even though unintentionally it caused someone's death, it's a very serious matter and a very, and perhaps even a very costly matter for the one who committed the injury.
Right. And what, when I think one of the guys I was reading about this said, the desire in this case, if you're not, if you don't deal with this, like we're using the city of refuge, you've got the potential of adding to the tragedy of an accidental homicide. You can call it involuntary manslaughter. Some people call it that. Depends on how it's, you know, but something that just accidentally happens. You're adding, with the Avenger of Blood, takes life, you're adding voluntary manslaughter, at least, if not murder, to it. Depending on what lengths he is actually going to make that happen. So it said we're trying to keep a true crime from being added to a tragedy.
Pastor Dan.
Yes?
So when you say a true crime, if the Avenger did end up killing him, but it also says if the involuntary, the guy that accidentally killed, leaves the city...
That's different.
And gets killed.
He's violated the terms of his own protection.
Well, yeah, I see that, but like, why does that make it okay for the other guy to kill him?
That's a good question. Some people would say it exposes maybe his own, maybe things that he couldn't have been convicted for, you know, that there wasn't enough to convict him, but the fact that he's willing to sneak around something like this is one thing. But it's not that... He is trying to get around the consequences of the action, even if it was accidental. He's trying to get around the consequences of it, so he's going to bear the penalty. And it's a stiff penalty.
I had a question.
Yes.
You know, is the, you know, where it says, and he hadn't hated him previously in his heart, is, would that be part of the investigation?
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
try
yeah.
to find out what his relationships were and
yeah.
so forth.
Exactly.
To exonerate him or not.
Yep. Okay, moving into chapter 21, briefly about the allotment to Levi. And I'm not going to go into all the details through the chapter. I'm going to look at the very first part of the chapter and the very end of it instead of going into each little area. But then the heads of the fathers' houses of the Levites came to Eleazar the priest and to Joshua the son of Nun and to the heads of the fathers' houses of the tribes of the people of Israel. And they said to them at Shiloh in the land of Canaan, the Lord commanded through Moses that we be given cities to dwell in, along with their pasture lands for our livestock. So by command of the Lord, the people of Israel gave to the Levites the following cities and pasture lands out of their inheritance. And there's this long going, starting at verse 4, all the way through 40. It says, the cities of the Levites in the midst of the possession of the people of Israel were in all 48 cities with their pasture lands. These cities each had its pasture lands around it. So it was with all these cities. Thus the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to their fathers, and they took possession of it and settled there. The Lord gave them rest on every side just as he had sworn to their fathers. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All had come to pass. Let's see the numbers. At the beginning of chapter 35 in Numbers, it also talks about this. This is where the promise was. The Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan Jericho, saying, command the people of Israel to give to the Levites some of the inheritance of their possession as cities for them to dwell in. And he actually goes very specific about how it's laid out. And you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities. So it's not just the city itself, but the pasture land around it. The city shall be theirs to dwell in, and their pasture lands shall be for their cattle and for their livestock and for all their beasts. The pasture lands of the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall reach from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits all around. And that's about 0.6 miles all the way around. That's about 3,000 feet. And you shall measure outside the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, on the south side 2,000 cubits, west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, the city being in the middle. This shall belong to them as pasture land for their cities. And then the cities that you give to the Levites shall be the 6 cities of refuge, where you shall permit the manslayer to flee. In addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. That's a total of 48. And then verse 8, and as for the cities that you shall give from the possession of the people of Israel, from the larger tribes you shall take many, and from the smaller tribes you shall take few. So it's kind of like the House of Representatives, you know, it's based on population, as opposed to just, you know, the bigger tribes get an equal amount, so that means the impact on the different tribes will be proportional to their size. In proportion to the inheritance that it inherits, shall give of its cities to the Levites. Now, this is not an inheritance per se, but it is an allotment. It's not an inheritance, but it's more of an allotment. Because it says in other places, the cities and pastures instructed by God were promised by Moses. And when they came to him, as we saw in Joshua, they are merely asking for what they had been promised, just like Caleb was getting what he had promised, been promised in the previous chapter. But the reason for this is, if you think about the Levites as the priestly tribe, this is where all the priests are, how stupid would it be within our land that every pastor, every teacher, every seminary professor, every person who is equipped and able to teach the people, they all stay in New York. And everybody else in the rest of the country is just on their own. That'd be silly, right? That doesn't make any sense. What he is doing is he is spreading out the priestly influence throughout Israel. He's making sure that it's all through the land, that there is a priestly influence. And remember, when we talk about the priestly influence, it's not just the priest, but it's also the scribes who are the ones who were equipped to teach the law to the people. So it is also connected with the cities of refuge. Because, as Dr. Phillips was saying, you know, there's the aspect, maybe there's appellate court, but also the fact that there is a very present influence of the wisdom and understanding of the law of God, wise men who can properly ask the questions. You know? So, so the purposes of Levi's allotment, as I said, there's a priestly influence spread out among the people instead of all huddled in one place. That the Lord himself is their inheritance. The Lord himself is their inheritance, because that's what it says in other places earlier in the book of Joshua. That the Lord is their inheritance. But at the same time, the Lord is providing for their needs. He's putting them in the midst of this land. He's giving them land for their pasture, you know, for their beasts and their flocks and to raise food and do all this kind of stuff. They got it going out basically from these small little villages, 0.6 miles out in every direction. Adequate for the cities. I never really thought about this, but basically the priests are like sojourners. Now, they are citizens. They are people of great influence as priests and scribes, but at the same time, they're also sojourners. They go where they're needed. They don't have something they say, this is mine and I'm staying here. They go where they have to go. I wouldn't necessarily, well, it's kind of an illustration, but it's not exactly, so please, I'm not claiming anything particular in this. But when I was living in Virginia, And I was being approached by this church in Montana to pastor their church. That was an enormous jump for us. I'm from Mississippi, Kentucky. My wife's from Alabama. We're Deep South Southerners. Montana's like another country where they're Americans and speak English, you know. It's just a different culture, different climate, different everything. Great people, but it's just different. Can't even find sweet tea up there. Anyway. So, I know that it's sacrifice for the Lord, you know. If you make room. But there was a period of time where I was really struggling with it. I mean, I loved the people up there. I cared for them. I wanted to have a pastor. They didn't have one. And it took about a year and a half. And eventually, for me, I got to the point where I felt like if I did not go, I would be in disobedience. That was the way it felt. I'd be disobeying if I didn't go. I needed to go where I was needed. And while it was difficult, in retrospect, I know it was the right thing to do. So, I'm not putting myself in the place of these priests and scribes going into their cities of refuge and setting up their places, but it's similar to that. You know, you got to go where you're needed. In a sense, you are a sojourner. You know? And the offerings go to them. That's in another passage where it talks about, you know, the offerings that are made go to the priests. That's where they can eat from. They can use that. Many see this as the Old Testament justification for compensating pastors. There are a few that don't. There are a few churches out there, denominations, or whatever you want to call it, that do not believe in a vocational clergy. They only believe in bivocational, that you don't compensate pastors at all. Ever. Those would also typically not believe in a church building either. Typically. But the thing is, despite their spiritual functions, they still have practical earthly needs. Everybody eats. You know? My kids have got a lot of gall. They eat three times every day. I cannot believe that. But they do. So, the biggest point to see here is that it is not merely God's faithfulness to the Levites, which He is doing. He is providing for the needs of the Levites just as He's provided for everybody else. But that He is also offering spiritual provision to all of Israel. I said through the Israelites, I meant through the Levites. He is providing spiritual provision for all of Israel through the Levites. So everybody is providing for everybody else. The rest of Israel is being used by God to provide for the needs of the Levites by setting up those cities. The offerings go to them, offering make sure pasture land is available for them. And also, the Levites are providing for the spiritual needs and the teaching and instruction and oversight and shepherding of the people of Israel. So it works together. Everybody has their function. And at the end, just to close that passage in Joshua, at the end of chapter 21, it's a great testimony, is that the Lord gave to Israel all the land that He swore to their fathers. And they took possession of it, and they settled there, and the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as He had sworn to their fathers. Notice how He says this multiple times, just as He had sworn to their fathers. Not one of all their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. all had come to pass. That God was good to his promise. God was good to his promise. We'll see in the next few chapters in a couple of weeks some final incidents that go on in the closing out of the book and the renewal of covenant and Joshua's final words as he is being dragged off the stage of biblical history. We'll see that in a couple of weeks. Are there any other questions or thoughts, comments? You're looking out, you have a question. Okay. All right. Will, can you close us in prayer?
Lord, we thank you for this time we have to learn through your word.